Interview, a podcast that is... Saving Throw Interview, a podcast that isn't a podcast, in much the same way that my column isn't a column. I am Scott, your faithful writer, recording type guy, and with me is Gareth Michael Starka. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that right. And
yeah, that's my first time.
Okay, and I'm going to throw that, and I'm going to throw you the traditional first question of any interview is, who the heck are you and why are you here?
Oh, I am a writer, publisher, and game designer. I've been working in the tabletop games industry since the early 90s, and I'm here because I have always wanted to do an interview on a podcast that is not a podcast for a column that is not a column.
Yes. All right. And I've brought you on to talk about your newest project for Adamant Entertainment, which is Far West. Could you describe that to me?
Yeah, actually, Far West is... it's actually a transmedia project, which is a horribly, horribly buzzwordy term for a fictional setting that is explored across multiple narrative platforms. That's what they tell me. Basically, think of it as ancient pre-21st century speak. It's a franchise that is really tightly coordinated. You can examine the setting through books, or in our case, through a role-playing game, through television, through, you know, the classic examples, of course, would be like Star Wars and Star Trek and all of the stuff where there's just scads and scads of stuff out there. We're doing Far West as a transmedia thing because there was so much that I wanted to do with the setting, and what we're launching with, we've got our website up, which is intothefarwest.com. And the website has like short fiction and development articles and things like that. But our first actual product that we're launching is an adventure game, tabletop role playing game. To tell you a little bit about the setting, imagine like a fantasy world, but not one that's based on the usual medieval or Dark Ages European cultures and myths, but rather one that's based on the inspirations of spaghetti westerns and Chinese wuxia. To that rather heady mix, we chuck in steampunk elements and sort of create rich stew of awesome. I was trying to sort of give a summary to someone who was asking me, yeah, but you know, can you give me specifics? And I said, it's like Stephen King's Dark Tower meets the Storm Riders, meets Deadwood, meets Afro Samurai, meets Wild Wild West, meets Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, meets Django, meets Briscoe County Jr., meets House of Flying Daggers, etc., etc.
See, you're just hitting all my buttons, because I loves me some spaghetti westerns and wuxia and the Dark Tower and Afro Samurai, but I still haven't watched the second Afro Samurai thing. I really should. I think it's on the Netflix. I don't know why I haven't. But, okay. Obviously, steampunk just goes with anything. It's like chili flakes. You can just add it. You can put steampunk in anything, and it works.
Yeah, the reason we haven't done a standalone steampunk game is because, like you say, you know, the chili flakes analogy, I view steampunk as a seasoning, not a main course.
And what's weird is, I'm going to go on a tangent about steampunk fiction for a second, and feel free to throw your thoughts in, but steampunk fiction does not have much of its own genre templates. Like, from what I've read, it's either it's either depressing industrial age fiction along the lines of sort of Dickens, but with, you know, even more exploitive because there's Babbage machines all over the place, or it's just Victorian adventure fiction with just a little more out there in terms of the tech, like Jules Verne, H.G. Wells stuff, just with a slightly different coat of paint on it.
Exactly.
And a lot of people are actually sort of bothered by steampunk. I don't get it. Do you have any theories as to why people have ire towards steampunk?
I think that it's just another example of that group over there looks like they're having a lot of fun doing something that I'm not particularly interested in. Therefore, it must be bad, wrong fun. Our particular niche, my fellow geeks and I, we don't tend to react well to things where people appear to be having a good time with something that we don't personally like. And rather than just saying, meh, it's not for me, we have to develop a certain amount of ire about it. And I think that the steampunk hate is just another example of that. And you saw the same thing in the 90s with the goth fans brought into gaming by Vampire. So, you know, the goths were obviously having bad, wrong fun. And going back even further, I mean, it predates my time in the business, but I guarantee you that the same thing happened when the Wargamers started complaining about these damn role-playing kids.
Yeah. Well, I think I have a theory, at least, just to respond to the goth kids who came into gaming. I've read a pile of Old World of Darkness books. There are a few in there that are definitely in the bad, wrong, fun territory.
To each his own, my friend. To each his own.
Yes. Getting into the two bigger halves of this stew you've made is you have Wuzha fiction and you have the spaghetti western. And on your blog, you've mentioned a bunch of influences. And there's a few movies that have mashed these really well. And what do you think it is about these two styles that really come together so well for being so disparate in terms of location?
Well, and here's where I make people's brains go explodey.
That's your warning, folks.
Yeah, that is your warning. So if you're prone to exploding brain, grab your heads right now. Here's the deal. Spaghetti Western and Wuzha fiction and film are the same thing. I'll let that sink in. Okay, now that you've recovered, I'll explain myself. Both Spaghetti Western and Wuzha fiction are heavily mythologized interpretations of a historical past, specifically the sort of frontier period historical past, where the main protagonist is a wandering hero, and the villains are usually the wealthy or the powerful. You can take any spaghetti western plot and stick it into, you know, Han period China or any of the other Wuzha, traditional Wuzha settings, and it will map almost one for one. You could say, oh, wow, I could do a Wuzha version of that. And the same way, translating in the other direction, by taking a traditional Wuzha story and sticking it in the West, you can get it's again one for one mapping. I noticed this is because they were always interests that I had, and I started noticing it with actually Japanese film, the not the Wuzha stuff, but the Samurai Chambara stuff. And as I was noticing the similarities between the Chambara films and the Wuzha films, I then started to compare. It was easy to see the connection between samurai films and westerns because, well, some of the best spaghetti westerns are essentially remakes of samurai movies.
And some of the best samurai movies are remakes of westerns.
Yeah, vice
like
versa. Yeah.
John Ford, Kurosawa, Leone, watch them all in order and see the Blaine exploding occur.
But when I then thought about the Wuzha film and how it was different from the samurai film, I realized that there was even a closer corollary between the subject matter of the Chinese stuff and the Westerns than there was in the Japanese stuff. Because, for one thing, the Chinese actually had a frontier.
Oh, what are you talking about? There was the wild untamedness of Okinawa.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, and especially if you take a look at some of the Wuxia films that take place near, like, near Mongolia or the western deserts, things like Dragon Gate Inn and stuff like that, it's all that you are missing is Clint Eastwood in a serape. I mean, it's practically the same kind of stuff, and spaghetti westerns, as distinct from like a traditional western, when the Italians made the westerns, they usually knew, you know, sod all about American geography or history. So they just sort of threw stuff in that they thought was cool. So the Italian and to, you know, to an equal extent, the, you know, German and other European westerns take place in this sort of nebulous Western-ish setting that doesn't really bear a whole lot of similarity to the actual West,
And looks a heck of a lot like Turkey.
or Almeida, Spain, or it, and you know, it's one of the reasons why you don't have a lot of spaghetti Westerns that involve Native Americans, because there weren't a lot of Europeans who could convincingly play a Native American. So you have a lot of the spaghetti Westerns deal with border stuff around Mexico, because they could always cast Spaniards and yeah. But you ended up with this sort of detached sense of reality where it's almost is like it's set in a fantasy world already. And the more I started playing around with that thought and the sort of fairy tale nature of some of the Wuxia stuff, all of these things just sort of clicked into place like a giant Tetris board in my head. And I said, wow, I really need to do this, because everybody I talked to about it had the same reaction that you had, which is, wow, you're hitting all of my buttons.
But yeah, okay. I'm gonna get into the specifics of the setting in just a second, but this is something in just something I've been thinking about and listening to a lot of audio interviews with John Wick, is that what's interesting about Wuxia and Spaghetti Western is that they focus on these loner anti-hero types who don't stick around in one place, which tends to lend itself well to what one thinks of when one does a tabletop role-playing game. Whereas a lot of games, like Legend of the Five Rings or Chin, are sort of focused on, what's John Wick's new one? Blood and Honor, I think. Is that it is about taking these Western-style heroes and then sticking them in this Eastern setting, this very Eastern societal environment, and kind of grinding them down. And what are your thoughts on that with going into Far West?
Well, how do you mean?
I don't know,
I'm not
just this odd.
sure I get what you mean by grinding them down.
Well, this is something that comes up is that more so in Blood and Honor is that if you want to play a Ronin in Blood and Honor, you don't get half a character sheet. Like half of it's gone. Whereas something like in L5R, you could play a Ronin, but you couldn't quite do it that well. Whereas like the setting and a lot of the mechanics tend to be structured that it's about groups and power bases that you play a part of.
Oh,
Very.
okay, I see what you mean. And
Yeah.
how do I handle that sort of thing for Far West?
Yeah.
Well, first and foremost, the best, whereas a lot of the spaghetti westerns deal with a sort of solo hero or occasionally a small group, you know, like a band of outlaws or something.
Well, there were seven, and they were apparently magnificent.
Yeah. There's in the Chinese inspirations, the Wuxia fiction, and then later the films, there is much more focus on bands of heroes, like, you know, the outlaw brothers and that sort of thing. And the biggest structure and the sort of biggest structural peg that I can hang my coat on for doing an adventure game in that sort of setting is the Wuxia concept of clans, specifically the secret societies where they would have these sort of loose affiliations that share an allegiance to a secret society, and the secret society teaches, you know, their own special form of kung fu and things like that, which gives you pretty much a ready-made structure for a playing group. But also the fact that a lot of those clans would work together, you know, this week, but next week they might be fighting each other over some lost scroll that teaches a new form of kung fu or whatever. It gives you the option of having groups of heroes working together or you know, working together on this adventure, but maybe working against each other on the next one. So it just, if you think of it as in terms of stereo channels, if I've got like Spaghetti Western in one channel and Chinese Wuxia on the other channel, if I come upon a difficulty, like you said, the individual versus the group or other things that traditionally have been sort of stumbling points for a role-playing game, it just becomes a matter of turning up the inspiration from one channel or the other. And in this case, just sort of turning up the Chinese angle, which emphasizes groups over individuals, pretty much took care of that.
Okay, and getting into the specifics, you say it's sort of a fantasized version of China and with a bit of the Old West added in. Is this, are we talking about like an alternate history, or is this, you know,
actually
Middle Earth? But
the way I originally explained, I didn't want to do like the American West with Kung Fu, because that would basically be sort of like redoing Deadlands, except with Kung Fu replacing the magic.
It'd be like a third of Deadlands.
I didn't want to do China with Western elements because not enough gamers know anything about China to begin with, and so the amount of effort it would take to get them to a basic familiarity level would completely negate the reasons for using a real setting in the first place. So what I did was what Stephen King did with The Dark Tower. I created a completely separate fantasy world, but one that's based on the sort of tropes that are recognizable, so that you have that sort of familiarity, but you're not constrained by reality, for lack of a better word. You mentioned Middle Earth, and when I was originally doing development work on this, I was basically saying, well, imagine if Tolkien had created Middle Earth instead of basing it on his construction of Middle Earth on Northern European myths, languages, and history, he had instead sat down and watched a bunch of kung fu movies and a bunch of spaghetti westerns and then created it.
Did not know Tolkien needs a time machine in this scenario, but well, that's kind of awesome.
Yeah, well, I mean, I figure, you know, getting Tolkien a time machine is probably the smallest part of the work involved here.
Yeah.
Getting him to sit still for a kung fu movie is probably larger.
A lot of Wuxia movies tend to have this. How much of the supernatural are you bringing in from the Wuxia movies? Is it just going to be like wire foo stuff, or are we going to be seeing like ghosts and like old wizards who throw fireballs?
Actually, not. No, we're apart from over the top kung fu. We're not doing really any supernatural. Part of the reason is that I thought that westerns plus supernatural was already done and done really well by Deadlands, so I didn't really feel the need to reinvent the wheel there. The other part is when you get right down to it, there are two types of Wuxia, and it kind of hurts my head to say this, but one is more quote-unquote realistic, and the other is much more over the top. Basically, you know, the difference between, say, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon versus Storm Riders, for example. Things like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and House of Flying Daggers, and Hero, and things like that, that they still have the people flying around and running up walls and doing amazing things that are clearly supernatural. But they don't have monsters, ghosts, etc., whereas, you know, Storm Riders have basically like a superhero movie. There are people are shooting bolts of cosmic whoop-ass out of their fists and you know, shooting laser beams out of their eyes and that kind of stuff, which is way more sort of comic booky, over-the-top kind of stuff. We're going with the former rather than the latter. we felt that it mixed better with the Western stuff anyway.
Getting back to the steampunk, how much is that going to play in? How high is the steam on this? Is it just going to be, you know, crazy gizmos and rocket packs, or are we going to have like computers and spy satellites like we had in the Difference Engine?
Wuja Tales feature the you know, like I said, they can feature the over the top high flying kung fu, but that they don't often involve magic as like fantasy fans would define it. The majority of magical elements in the Wuja stories are actually like secret knowledge, hidden techniques, alchemy, that kind of stuff, which are supernatural, but sort of within the realm of science as it was understood at the time. And so that set off a chime in my head, which was, you know, supernatural, but within the realm of understood science. Given the 19th century vibe of the Western, the best analog to that would be steampunk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, far-fetched, but within the realm of quote-unquote science. So we're not going... you know, we do have things like clockwork automatons and airships and things like that, but I guess on a 1 to 10 scale, I'd put our steampunk elements around a 6 or a 7.
All right,
you know,
good. I might have been annoyed if I could not dropkick a robot.
Exactly. Basically, things that were possible with the science at the time, or but just hadn't been done. Or things that you have a reasonable suspension of disbelief for. I'm you know, we're not talking like space travel and that kind of stuff, but enough. I guess the best example I could give would be the Wild Wild West, the really awesome 1960s TV show, not the absolute abomination film from a couple. You know, with Will Smith and whatnot from a decade or so back. The kind of stuff that you see in the original Wild Wild West, which it was sort of like almost to the level of like 19th century versions of James Bond style gadgets, you know, still within the plausible deniability realm of reality.
So you're just reading Da Vinci's notebooks a bit?
Yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah, exactly. And you know, that tied in, like I said, to the stuff that you see in the Wuja fiction, where you've got like the Chinese alchemy and stuff like that, which they're doing things which the Chinese claimed at the time and in some areas still claim were possible, but which our current science tells us they're not sure. You know, things like the secret elixirs and that kind of stuff. That's basically, you know, if I was to put a label on it, that sort of Chinese alchemy would almost be like the steampunk equivalent of chemistry, you know?
Okay. And getting into the game's mechanics for a little while, what sort of system are we looking at? Is this a very new bunch of new stuff? Just like a D20 hack? What are we looking at?
It is basically, essentially a D20 hack, but a D20 hack in the way that Mutants and Masterminds 3rd Edition is a D20 hack. Mutants and Masterminds was built on the D20 frame, but if you looked at the current rules, it's not quite so easy to find that lineage in it.
Like you can't just run through your SRD and note in the new bits.
The way that I explained it is that knowledge of the D20 system isn't required to play it. We view the D20 stuff as pretty much the technology that underpins the game. It's sort of like formed the basis of our engine, meaning that you can enjoy like tearing around the curves and straightaways without ever popping the hood. But for folks who are familiar with the workings of D20, the engine will make sense to you, which means that, like any other gearhead, you can, you know, put it up on jacks and tinker with it to your heart's content, because you know basically how it works.
All right, so what are you bringing in that is making this game so different from your Player's Handbook 3rd Edition?
Okay, well, I can break it down for you if you'll forgive my long-windedness here. I actually have a summary sheet.
Go for it. These guys have listened to these guys have listened to people from Vampire the Masquerade talk for a while. I think we can handle long-winded.
All right. Basically, the idea is there are no character classes. Everyone is a single, quote-unquote, class. Your differentiation between characters come from your backgrounds and your occupations, which a background is, you know, where you came from, what shaped you, and your occupation is what you were originally trained to do before you became an adventurer. Those give you your basic areas of knowledge, and the old style class abilities, you know, since there are no classes, they don't exist anymore. There are things which are called edges, which I'll get to in a minute. There are three common starting ranks for characters. The basic rank, the equivalent would be something around like a fourth level character in traditional D20. Advanced, which would be eighth, and master, which would be 12th. Above that are legends, which are 16th and higher. There is no experience point progression. It's a system of narrative progression only. Abilities, you got the standard ability set, you know, strength and was, you know, that the standard abilities that everybody knows. But they're rated in bonuses only rather than on the numeric scale. So, you know, you've got a strength of +1 or a strength of +3, not a, you know, a 14 or a 18.
Which translates to the +2 and +4, which I'm surprised it took us this long to skip that step. Like when I first read Flip Through M&M 3rd Edition, I smacked myself in the face. It's like, why not?
Yeah, really, that, you know, once you've got the bonus, you never use the other number. So there's also an ability called Spirit, which is based on your wisdom and bonuses for your power level, and it can also be raised by different edges. It's basically your chi. It's a points pool that's used to power kung fu, but can also be used as a reserve for any role because it's your inner strength. It rises and falls throughout the game, sort of like hit points, with awards and penalties based on achievements and circumstances. There is also the possibility of gaining corrupt spirit through play, but we'll have more on that later. All saving throws have been chucked out the window. They're replaced by simple ability checks. So, for example, like a reflex check is just your dexterity, a social check is just your charisma, etc. So therefore, it's sort of possible to have a quote-unquote save based on any ability. Then we add in material from outside of the D20 world. We're basically bringing in the aspect economy from the Fate system.
Do you like us some Fate over here at RP Gamer?
Yeah, the fact that it's also OGL, it seems to me, why not just take all of the open content stuff and mix it together and see what you get? As per Fate, you know, aspects are descriptors that add unique flavor to each character. They can be tagged by the player for bonuses, but can also be used by the GM to compel. You spend, basically, Spirit becomes our version. Not only is it used to power Kung Fu and stuff, but you also use it sort of like the Fate points in Fate, where you spend it to tag, you know, that kind of thing. Characters have two aspects which are based on two of the traditional eight virtues of the Wuxia. Altruism, justice, individualism, loyalty, courage, truthfulness, disregard for wealth, and desire for glory. Plus an additional aspect for any ability that you have ranked at +3 or higher, which must be somehow linked to that ability. Additional aspects are possible depending on the rank of the character, etc. And there's also the possibility of gaining corrupt aspects, which is based on an idea that Ryan Macklin had about using Fate for Star Wars and having dark side aspects, which are basically aspects that you can tag for free, but they make you more and more corrupt the more you use them. And that gets into the sort of, like, you know, corrupt chi stuff from the Wuxia stories. Skills we've eliminated entirely. Everything is handled via ability checks, plus bonuses based on your rank and your background / occupational areas of knowledge, and bonuses from your edges. For example, your hero could use your dexterity to ride a horse, but would only get a regular dex check plus the bonus for their rank. A hero with a rancher background would get a dex check plus their rank bonus, but an additional bonus because of their background. A hero with an expert horseman edge would get additional bonuses on top of that. And if a character had an aspect like Hellbent for Leather, they could tag that and get more of a bonus. So we've just basically gotten rid of individual skills and replaced them with more areas of knowledge and that apply to your ability checks. Now, when I mentioned edges, feats and class talents of the standard D20 have been eliminated and replaced with edges, which combine their functions. Sort of like the stunts in Fate. Edges are nifties, basically. You know, cool stuff you can do. And a PC gets basically edges based on your rank. And some of them have prerequisites and some of them don't. And that's how you customize your character through like the picking and choosing of different edges. For those of you familiar with the D20 engine, the number of edges you have that basically will match the class talent plus feat progression from D20 Modern. So the if you want to get an idea of the general power level, what you know, the number of edges you can expect, take a look at how many class talents and feats that you'd have at a particular level in D20 Modern, and that's roughly where we're going. Kung Fu, of course. Martial training is an edge, which allows you to have a style. You can choose from the example styles that we'll provide or design your own. And you can take that edge multiple times, which would allow you to learn multiple styles. The Kung Fu system is based on your spirit, with more powerful techniques requiring greater spirit expenditure to use. And the styles are designed with a points buy system, with a budget determined by the character's rank and what their max spirit is. Combat, no hit points. Similar to Mutants and Masterminds, we use a toughness save, which is based on your constitution, with results tracked in wound levels rather than you know, I do 6 points. No, you've got a light wound, you know, that kind of thing. Initiative is another ability check using an average of dexterity and wisdom. The attack is either dexterity if it's ranged or strength if it's physical. Defense is strength if you're blocking, dex if you're avoiding. All of these, of course, can be modified by different edges. We've got a chase system, which is based on the system that we designed that appeared most recently in the Tome of Secrets for Pathfinder. And we also have a stunt system. Short version, a roll of 20, when you roll a natural 20, it gives you a stunt point that you can set aside. And then later you can spend those stunt points to do awesome things like automatic successes, gaining a use of an edge that you don't already, that you don't usually have, to make small changes in the setting, like, you know, there's a gun lying on the table, I go for it, you know, that kind of thing, to negate hits against you, instantly kill minor characters, that kind of stuff, you know, just your hero point mechanic, essentially.
General awesomeness.
Yeah, and that is basically the sort of a top-level overview of what we're doing here. It gives you an idea of where of sort of the structure we're heading on it. This thing plays fast, fast, fast. We wanted to get rid of the paging through book after book after book of special abilities. And you know, as you said in our conversation earlier, the Player's Handbook 7 syndrome. Our original goal when designing the system was to come up with a character where you could, if you needed to, put everything that you need to know about that character on a single index card. And we've succeeded. So we're really pleased with it. And, you know, a lot of people are like, well, how come you didn't design something new? We did, but we just built it on stuff that has already been done. One of the main reasons for using D20 as the basis for what we were doing and then taking it as far as we can is the fact that the D20 stuff that's been done has been play tested by millions of gamers over more than a decade now. So it ain't broke. And also that means that most gamers have at least a passing familiarity with the concepts, which makes this game easier to pick up. Once you see, you know, once we tell you, well, here's what we based this on and here's how it works, there's that aha moment, and then everything just sort of clicks into place.
And it's not like there's a bunch of game masters out there who haven't already slapped aspects into D20.
Exactly. And the other thing is that as a guy was telling me at Origins, it also allows people to go to their decade plus collection of things that they've purchased over time that are collecting dust, pull it down off the shelf and say, well, since this uses the same basic engine, how can I adapt this for use with Far West? You know, how can I take this module, which was intended for you know, the third edition D&D, and drop it into the Far West setting? All the game master at that point has to do is think about how the setting information changes, because given that the rules are based on the same building blocks, actually translating the stats and everything will be a piece of cake.
Okay, and obviously you went through a lot of stuff, and I made a few notes about questions I wanted to come back to, so let's just do this one. Is if you're going to have every stat basically function as a save, how's that going to play out? Obviously we're going to see some sort of basic social combat from a charisma save, but how does an int save, how do you differentiate a wisdom save from like an intelligence save? Or
that, you know, a wisdom save will obviously be used in situations where willpower is important. Off the top of my head, I can't think of any situation where, and well, actually, no, it's the old thing where if memory, for example, if it's crucial for a player character to remember something, and it's something that the player, it's something from their past or whatever, it's something that hasn't been established already that the player doesn't know themselves. The game master could have the character roll an intelligence save to remember a detail. You know, that just came out of off the top of my head as an example. But in reaction to an attack, that I can't think off the top of my head right now of an attack that would target intelligence.
Unless this somehow ends up devolving into a contest of trivia knowledge.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, duel of obscure medical terms.
And that could definitely fall into part of a that also dovetails in with like the idea of a social combat system too. So
okay, and obviously you're talking about, you're probably still in development of martial arts styles, but are we going? But when it comes to the spaghetti western side of things, are gunfights going to play out like a Leone movie? Or are we going to be jumping forward in kung fu movies to John Woo stuff?
It depends on the combatants. There are some of the clans that we've developed, which we've gone into in a little detail over on the Far West website, that have kung fu styles that are built around firearms. And that's definitely the sort of John Woo kind of stuff. Although, actually, it's even a bit farther than that. It's like, take the stuff that you've seen in Wuxia films with a sword and do it with guns. So you've got, you know, shooting an opponent's bullet out of the air kind of stuff, you know. But obviously, if it's we try to be faithful to both inspirations, so both types of combats are possible.
Okay, so you'll be able to have a barroom brawl without a wire team just off camera.
Yeah, like I said, it depends on the individual combatants involved. You know, sometimes your barroom brawl is going to end up looking like the tea house fight from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, with people like jumping from level to level and stuff, because, well, that's awesome. But really, when you get right down to it, it's the same old barroom brawl.
Obviously, you've put anything that maybe hasn't been gone on the blog yet, or something about the setting or the mechanics that you're really excited about and you just want to fanboy to all these people?
Actually, it's like I said, we've got a ton of stuff over on intothefarwest.com. And I mean, we've been going since the beginning of June with that site, and for the month of June we were daily. So there's a ton of material over there, including looks at a bunch of the clans that we've developed, as well as a bunch of short fiction vignettes, which give you a lot of detail about the settings.
All right, getting into sort of the multimedia project that's surrounding this. Once the game comes out, what are we going to be looking at? Comic books? Cartoon?
We've got a bunch of stuff in development. The first stuff that you're going to see after the game is probably going to be a fiction line. We did a poll on the website asking people, well, here's what we've got already underway. What do you want to see next? And far and away, the majority of people polled were saying that they wanted to see books. And so we're probably – I haven't – when I go to Gen Con, I need to finalize some arrangements with some other authors we're bringing in. But we're probably going to start with a short story collection just sort of like as a sampler. But we've also got underway a web series, which will be a combination of animation and live action. It's kind of hard for me to explain, and I haven't done a lot of public discussion of it yet. We want to make the look of the web series as much a mashup as the genre is, and so we're going to jump back and forth within a single episode into different visual styles, ranging from live action to animation to sort of stills to it's pretty cool. And the best thing I can the widest applicable example I can give is sort of like what Tarantino did with Kill Bill, where he broke away and had that anime sequence in the middle of it, and then went back and this section looks like an old kung fu movie. This section looks like a 70s revenge flick. You know, that kind of thing.
I don't know. For some reason, my head just jumped to Kung Fu Panda 2, maybe because I watched it last week, where the intro is this weird puppet show, and then it's the usual DreamWorks CG, and then all the flashbacks are in this Gennady Tarkovsky thick line animation look.
Oh, cool. I actually haven't seen Kung Fu Panda 2 yet. I've seen the first one, and they did something similar with that, the opening sequence being animation and then the traditional Pixar stuff. And people are like always surprised when I rave about Kung Fu Panda. For fans of Wuxia films, there are so many Easter eggs in those movies.
Oh yeah, tons.
And I, you know, my wife got me a big hardcover on The Art of Kung Fu Panda, which is a phenomenal book. And I always tell people, no, you don't understand. This was so good as far as its love of Wuxia that it actually made me overcome my absolute seething hatred of Jack Black.
But I like Jack Black in animated roles. He's a living cartoon character. It suits him better.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, if I don't have to look at him, that's great, you know?
Kung Fu Panda 2, definitely worth checking out. Cool. Jackie Chan has three times as much dialogue, so 30 words.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Let's hear it for Monkey. Yeah. What? No, it's, you know.
Well, they also bring in a bunch of other martial arts actors, like Jean-Claude Van Damme plays a crocodile, and
that's cool.
Michelle Yeoh is a goat.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, I haven't had time to go to see it because, well, like I said, I launched the Far West website at the beginning of June. We launched the Kickstarter for it yesterday. And so between point A and point B, I've been a little busy.
Yeah. And now that you've mentioned Kickstarter, I'll go into that. The next question is...
You like how I softballed that segue for you?
Oh, yeah. That's definitely... That's definitely high up on the ratings on the spooky outhouse scale of podcast segues.
Oh, yeah, I'm a pro, yo.
Yeah, yeah, that is definitely pro, but... And then, of course, the other move I've inherited from the spooky outhouse guys is calling attention to the segues.
But oh, yeah, I guess we kind of flubbed that, didn't we? Yeah.
Well, you know what? Sometimes people like a little behind-the-scenes banter.
There you
people
go.
Do. But, yeah, okay, Kickstarter. Obviously, you launched that yesterday. I'm going to definitely link this so you can support, show your money, throw some money behind this if you liked it. But what motivated you to go to Kickstarter? Just a little help getting a hard print run going? Or did you just see the Daniel Solis money and were like, I want the Daniel Solis money?
Actually, we had always envisioned Far West as being, you know, like I said, it's not limited to the games industry. We're going definitely outside of the traditional, here's an RPG and we're going to hang everything around that box, since we're sort of viewing it as the RPG is just part of the overall project. So our business model for Far West from the beginning was going to be create a fan base and then offer things directly to that fan base. And that is all about what Kickstarter is. That is flat out, you know, go to your fan base and say, we've got this cool thing, throw some money at it. And it takes almost all of the logistical concerns off the table and allows you to basically, it's really good at creating community, which we actually thought was more important than the funding issue, because funding we have covered. Adamant Entertainment has a print partnership with Cubicle 7, and they handle all of our stuff in print, and we release everything digitally. And so if we wanted to just go, you know, traditional, we're going to release this as an RPG and put it out there, we had that covered. But the idea of tapping into Kickstarter's ability to not only create a community specifically surrounding your product, but to get them excited and basically turn that community into sort of like your, you know, your alpha team, you know, the evangelists who then turn to their friends and say, check out this cool thing, and, you know, sort of spread that excitement. That is what Kickstarter offered. When I saw what Daniel had done with Doe Pilgrims of the Flying Temple, I was like, okay. I was aware of Kickstarter before. I mean, I've been a member of Kickstarter for since it went live. I just hadn't done any projects yet, mostly because I was, you know, had a lack of time. When Daniel did his, I was like, that's exactly right. It's you know, you saw it became this sort of perfect storm of people who were excited to get on board and were so excited they wanted to get other people to get on board with them. And it appears that particular bloom is not off the rose yet, because we launched our Kickstarter, I'm looking at the clock now, 23 hours ago. We reached our minimum funding level in the first 15 hours. We set this up to be a 45-day project, meaning that we'll be taking pledges for 45 days, even above our funding levels, because obviously the more we bring in, the more we're able to do. And for us to have reached our goal, which was $5,000, was like the minimum we could, you know, $5,000 was like basically the minimum for us to put out a limited edition full color hardcover to just the handful of people who participated. We reached that point 15 hours in, and so now it becomes a matter of setting new goals and seeing what more we can offer people, where we're going. You know, today I posted an update that said if we can reach 10,000, I'll add an exclusive supplement that'll go out to everybody who's already pledged. They don't have to pledge any additional money. It's just going to be a reward because we've got more funding and can do more stuff. I think that we have not, we meaning the industry, and for that matter, the wider hobby, I don't think we've really grasped exactly how much of a game changer this sort of funding model is. The idea of going directly to the sort of people who are interested in what you are doing, and not just saying, hey, buy this thing, but saying, hey, I want you to be a part of the project. Because to a large extent, that sort of psychology is already there in geek circles already. I mean, like, the main reason that, you know, we get annoyed when something like Firefly gets canceled is because we feel like it's ours, right? Well, with Kickstarter, that's actually true. We can actually, you know, if somebody wanted to do Firefly, for example, or, you know, if Joss Whedon was to start Firefly today, he could go up on Kickstarter and create a community of people, and it really would be theirs. And so the ability to go to your fans and say, I want you to be a part of this and make this part of, you know, have you be investors in the project. You are as much a part of this as the creative team is. It's huge. It's absolutely huge. And I don't think that we are even seeing the tip of the iceberg on what's possible. And, you know, as I mentioned on my personal blog today, intellectually, I kind of grasped that, especially after seeing what happened with Daniel Solis. But actually doing it and seeing it happen myself is absolutely blowing my mind.
Yeah. Of course, now that we've mentioned this, Joss Whedon's going to finish Avengers, and there's going to be a Kickstarter project for Serenity 2.
Hey, I have actually sent emails to the people I know who were involved in and have access to Joss Whedon, and I've said, tell him to crowdfund it as a web series and sit back and rake in the money, because if he did that, well, not just him, but honestly, at this point, if I'm waiting, because the biggest lament of geeks is, you know, I really loved this awesome show and they don't make it anymore. You know, everybody, you know,
everyone's got two shows that at least,
yeah, that they loved that were canceled. And with this type of model and with web distribution of video, nothing needs to be canceled ever again, as long as there is money there. You know, if as long as the audience is willing to throw money at it, it'll keep getting made, and someone is going to do that and do that in a big way within the next 5 years, I'm sure. To be honest, I'd love it if it was us.
So, any Wii owners out there who really want an English, North American release of those three RPGs that Rainfall was after, maybe see if you can buy the rights off Nintendo this way.
Yeah, exactly.
But, okay, getting into your Kickstarter, what sort of stuff are we seeing for different pledge levels? Are we going to just be like, you know, throw down this, you get the PDF, or is there, like, cool Ultra Super Edition stuff for the guys who with serious wallets?
Oh, we have many, many different levels. The lowest level is $10, which just gets you an electronic edition.
Okay.
And that's your choice of a PDF, Kindle, or ebook version. The what I consider to be the core level is the $50 level, which is you get the electronic edition, but you also get a signed and numbered hardcover that's full color, and you're also listed in the acknowledgments with like the epithet of your choice. You know, for example, you know, Scott Eight Fists Watcher, you know, or Wachter, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you basically,
hey, second try, points for that.
Then, you know, we have, if you give a little more, you get a T-shirt. If you get a little more, you get membership in what we call the Far West Society, which is, it's the fan community for the Far West, which who will receive access to exclusive bonus materials, offers on, you know, exclusive offers on other merchandise. And most importantly, the Far West Society, we will consult the Far West Society on the direction of events that occur in the setting. So in a very real way, the fan community will be shaping the direction of the setting, so that, you know, you don't have the problem of sort of creator dictated meta plot that the fans don't like. You know, we also open up at upper levels. We offer things like a collection of prints featuring the artwork that was done by Far West art director Rick Hershey. When you start getting into the upper levels, we do things like we will write you, specifically you, a one-of-a-kind PDF adventure tailored to you, to your campaign. And when you get up to, like, the, you know, the as you said, the ridiculous wallet levels, like the $500 level is that basically they become a patron of the entire property, where not only do they receive all the stuff that we're giving out just for this Kickstarter, but you'll be receiving copies of every Far West product that we ever release for the lifetime of the property. You're with us for the long ride, you know? And then at the top levels, we've got things like, you know, we offer to send a member of the development team, you know, myself or T.S. Lucard, or to travel to your town and run your group through an exclusive adventure that we write just for that event.
And if I can get you 10,000, will you get Sam Elliott to come to my house and run the adventure?
You know,
because this is something I talked with about with Matt, the guy who's in charge of Deadlands, was like, Sam Elliott, kind of the guy you want running your Western game.
Well, I remember the Gen Con when Bruce Campbell played in the Deadlands LARP, which was pretty damn cool.
That would be damn cool.
But no, actually, at the top level, we've actually got, because our attitude with Kickstarter is, well, why the hell not? You know, the worst that can happen is that no one takes us up on it. But, you know, as many, many, many a teacher and parent has told me as I grew up, if you don't ask, they can't say yes. So at the top level, for $5,000, you become a producer of what we're working on. You're accredited as a producer. We will actually champion you with qualification for the transmedia producer credit from the Producers Guild of America. You'll be consulted on long-term planning, development. Basically, you become a part of our team. And, you know, we just figured, well, what the heck? We'll put it up and see what happens.
Someone might.
Yeah, and honestly, I'm always surprised when someone pledges anything, even at the $10 level. I'm like, for someone to take as much an interest in what we're working on to say, I'm excited about this, and I'm so excited about this, I'm going to pledge money towards it. That's just a phenomenal feeling. It makes, you know, I started development on Far West 4 years ago, and yesterday was a phenomenal day because watching the reaction when the Kickstarter went live kind of made those 4 years feel like they were worth it.
Yeah.
It was all I could do to avoid hitting refresh on my browser every 10 minutes. And I kind of failed at resisting that urge.
Okay, and obviously you've already got this community building. How's that, the reaction from your existing fan base for Adamant and just new people coming in with this project? How's that been for you?
It's been great, actually. That's one of the reasons why we decided to lead off with a role-playing game, is because we knew that we were going to be doing things outside of outside of that role-playing garden, so to speak. But that if we started with the role-playing game, that it would be the best way to take Adamant's existing fans and say, hey, come along with us and take a look at this new stuff we're doing. And so far, people have responded to it phenomenally, beyond our wildest expectations.
All right. And obviously, this is going to be your big thing for quite a while, but are there any other plans from Adamant kind of in the works in the background, things we should be looking forward to?
Oh, yes, indeed. We announced a while back that we had the license to produce a role-playing game based on the novels of China Mieville, Perdido Street Station, The Scar, Iron Council, etc. And
I'm pretty sure the next one's going to be titled I Am Smarter Than You.
And we'll be announcing, officially rolling out for distributors and everything next month, the announcement that the role-playing game Tales of New Crobazon will be shipping to stores in December of this year. I haven't actually publicly announced this anywhere else, so you're getting an exclusive, but I was planning on announcing this publicly before Gen Con as well, so might as well give you a teaser here. Adamant Entertainment will be producing, under license, the Buckaroo Banzai game.
Oh, man. That is serious.
Yes. We are producing in cooperation with the Banzai Institute a training manual for Blue Blazer regulars that takes the form of a tabletop role-playing game, which will enable Blue Blazer regulars to psychologically prepare for the sort of things that they may encounter while tasked with helping Buckaroo help us.
So how are you going to figure out setting out Jeff Goldblum?
Yeah, well, this is why they pay me the big bucks.
Yes.
Any day now, I'm sure that they will.
Any time now.
Yeah. I'm raking it, raking in that fat game design money. Dozens of dollars. Yes.
Web game design money, right up there with the mad web journalist monies.
Yeah, there you go.
One last question before I give you the stage to say whatever you like. But because this is obviously this website is majorly focused on console and computer RPGs, do you have any favorites from that side of things?
Right now, I am up to my eyeballs in L.A. Noire. I am loving the stuff that's coming out of Rockstar. It doesn't surprise me that it's for the past year or more, I have played basically constantly Red Dead Redemption, as you might imagine, given my particular interests. Then L.A. Noire came out, and that's been blowing my mind. And aside from that, I'm actually my deep dark secret is that I'm actually a fan of the stuff that EA Sports puts out too. I know that.
Well, the thing is the games aren't bad. It's the frequency of the games that is bad.
Yeah, I have to admit. Although, to be honest, I'm an absolute nut for what we refer to over on these shores as soccer. And getting a new FIFA game every year, on one level, I know it should annoy me, but I'm enough of an addict that I'm like, oh, but I've got to have the new team kits and the current lineups. And yeah, so they got me. They got their hooks deep into me.
Well, this is something I've said, is that the EA Sports things is not for gamers. It's for sports fans.
Yeah.
If you aren't a sports fan, you aren't going to get it. And if you are a sports fan, you've already bought your copy. It's the same thing with Dynasty Warriors, actually, where, you know what, people who like Dynasty Warriors, they buy every one, no matter what they think, what the actual innovation product to product is. But
I picked up, I can't even remember which version of Dynasty Warriors I picked up, because, you know, into Wuja. And I was not expecting to be inundated with sort of bad mid-80s Japanese pop metal.
Yeah.
But
well, that's Koei. They just love their bad 80s Japanese pop metal. Except you have to remember, Japan's about 15 years behind the curve musically, so that pop metal probably came out a year before the game did.
Yeah, I was sitting there going, wow, this is totally not what I was expecting. Other than that, you know, there is something satisfying about wading through an entire army just, like, knocking them down left and right.
And then you add giant robots to the mix, and you're like,
everything
well,
goes
that hooks me.
Everything goes better with giant robots.
Everything.
Yeah.
Everything. Count of Monte Cristo was improved with giant robots.
Yeah, exactly.
Fact.
Well, it's sort of like airships, you know. You chuck an airship, well, which they did chuck an airship into Count of Monte Cristo, oddly enough.
Well, have you seen the trailers for the new Three Musketeers?
Oh, yeah.
Airships.
And well, you know, they had me at Mila Jovovich in 3D, but all right, I think
I think
I've covered my consoles there.
Yeah, and I'm just gonna throw this to you to say whatever you like about Far West or any upcoming products from your company.
Wow, you know, to tell the truth, I don't think that there's anything that I haven't already covered, other than to say I would love it if people would go to intothefarwest.com and check out what we're doing. General updates on what my company is doing can be found at adamandentertainment.com. Between those two sites, I think you're pretty well covered. Those will have all of the links for the Twitters and the Facebooks, etc.
Okay, and hope you've got your pens handy, because the URL for the Kickstarter for this is kickstarter.com/products/adamant/far-west/western-wuja-mashup-adventure-game?ref=live.
Yeah,
there will be a link, but if you're driving, just remember that one.
Yeah, I was going to say, that one's probably better. Yeah, at this point, just go to intothefarwest.com, and we have a link there.
Okay. But it's been a pleasure talking. I will